It is Thursday night, and we are heading into the weekend as the jury deliberates. The prosecution and the defense both gave their closing arguments, and we have in studio with us, of course, Andre and I have been following this, and we've had the opportunity to check in with Eric Rung, who has been at the courtroom for many of the courtroom days, and including being every single one, and you've been in the courtroom for some of them. Oh, you're on five. 1 second. There you go.
Well, I've been in the overflow room for some of the testimony just because I'd have to pop out in and out just to give reports. But for the most part, and I was in the courtroom when Jason Van Dyke gave his testimony, which was, what everybody was waiting for in this case is to hear exactly how he would explain why he shot 16 times that night.
Yeah, that's an incredible day in courtroom history in Chicago, and I want to get your thoughts on that, too. And we also want to check in with Domati Pongo, who is at the at South Shore, where they had a press conference and a march there. Hey, Domati, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you guys?
Very well, thank you. So tell me, what was going on at South Shore?
So at 71st and Chappelle, some activists gathered. William Calloway was leading it. He was one of the activists that first, you know, helped in releasing a lot of the information around the Laquan McDonald shooting in the first place. But he and about, I would say, a little over two dozen other activists were there talking about what they plan to see. They were calling for a guilty verdict, and they were letting community members know, listen, let's make our voices heard, but let's not riot, let's not destroy our communities, and let's make sure we do this in a peaceful way.
I'm glad you brought that up too, Domati, because I know William Calloway has been very vocal about this. Good evening to you, by the way, and thanks for staying up and joining us, because I know you've been on this rally and protest all night too. But William Calloway has been very vocal, Willie Wilson, and I think even Laquan McDonald's mom one day outside of court said, please be peaceful. So is that kind of the message that you're sensing tonight, that whatever verdict is handed down, that there will be some sort of demonstrations, but the leaders of these demonstrations are urging for, no riots and just to be somewhat calm, but yet still expressing your either satisfaction or displeasure?
Yes, but what was interesting today, which was different than when I've heard William Calloway give the same message at the courthouse, was being on 71st and Chappelle, you had people walking past and just, like, organically joining the press conference. And there was one woman who walked past, and as William Calloway was speaking, she shouts out, ask them why did the police kill my son. Ask them why the police killed my son out of nowhere. And then just continues walking. And so Calloway said, listen, we're going to speak aggressively, passionately, and we're going to, shut the city down. We're going to march downtown in front of City Hall, but we're going to do it all peacefully. So there was an aggression, and there was still this idea.
Oh, no.
Mean kind marching, or does it mean that you might not say things that people might not agree with? So there was a fervor, like a passion and anger, but still this call for folks to be peaceful.
Domati, just out of curiosity, when this videotape, the dash camera video that we know all so well, you could almost feel kind of the intensity when these demonstrations were happening. Did you feel that same kind of intensity tonight?
I really did. I did. It was interesting because even outside the courthouse, every day there have been protesters out there. But, how many has varied. One day there may be four guys, and the next day there may be a dozen, et cetera. But today, even before the cameras came out from the news crews, there was a guy who had his Facebook Live phone up and had his camera on the police officers and was just shouting them down. He didn't touch them. He didn't get within 5 feet of them, but he was shouting them down aggressively. Other activists were just telling him, hey, just calm down. The police, the cameras are here. If they record you and they show you cursing, it's going to seem like, we're not presenting ourselves professionally. And so there was this energy, this tension between them and the half dozen or so police officers that were just there just to make sure that, everything was under control. But, yeah, it reminded me of the same energy that I saw a few years ago when the video first leaked and when I saw these activists marching up Michigan Avenue, shutting it down on Black Friday in 2015, I think that was.
Since we are so far into the, obviously now that it's gone to the jury a lot of people have had the opportunity to listen to testimony, to watch on CLTV, did you speak to anybody who had been following the courtroom as the story unfolded that way?
Yes, mainly Will and another activist who had been watching on CLTV back at home. And they started poke holes in these different things in the case. They weren't shy about saying that they felt that Jason Van Dyke's testimony contradicted what we saw in the video. Now, of course, the defense is saying that what the video shows is this perspective of a dash cam, a car that wasn't Jason Van Dyke's car. So we don't see in the video that looks like he's walking away. The defense would say he was actually walking toward Jason Van Dyke, closing in at about 13 feet or so. I know Eric will have more on that piece. But a lot of folks were talking about that. They're saying, you mean to tell me the defense, you know, someone I was talking to said, you mean to tell me the defense wants me to believe Jason Van Dyke's testimony over what I saw with my own eyes? And they were also saying that, you know, those tears won't work. You know, they felt that the tears were inappropriate, were insincere. And they also talked about the idea that he said that what he did was part of his police training. They said that it's hard for me to believe, and we have a serious problem if the police trains you to shoot someone 16 times within 6 seconds of arriving on the scene. And if the training does tell you that, then we have to make some changes as far as that goes as well.
Hey, Domati, also, as I'm sure you know, there were two of the alternate jurors that were dismissed tonight and spoke to reporters. Both of them said that if they were in that jury room, they would have voted guilty. One of the gentlemen said that he would have been voted guilty on first degree murder. The second said she was leaning toward second degree murder. As word of that got out, how did the protesters react to that? Obviously, I'm assuming that they think that it was that gives them some confidence going forward here. But were they surprised? How did they react to that?
Actually, at the time when I'd gotten there, I don't think, because they've been planning to protest all that time and folks were checking their phones, I don't know if they've seen that report yet from the alternate jurors, because they're running around all day working on the things of the case and working out that whole thing. But I did hear William Calloway say that he was okay with a first degree or a second degree murder conviction, which was something I hadn't heard them say before. They were saying that, I remember early on, you might remember this too, Eric, when Anita Alvarez first charged him with first degree murder, a lot of folks were scared that she'd overcharged him and, you know, didn't know that if a police officer in a shooting is found that he killed someone unjustified, that could be a first-degree murder charge. They were worried that the prosecution would have to find him, you know, would say that he premeditated that, like he woke up that morning and said he wanted to shoot Laquan McDonald. And so they said, listen, if he's found guilty of first or second degree murder, we're okay with that. And they're also skeptical about, you know, those alternate jurors don't represent the full jury makeup, which only includes one African American. Like Cook County is 25% black, Chicago 30% black. How is it 1/12 of the jury is African American? How are we going to get a fair shake in a case this racially charged? That's what folks are saying out there.
Hey, Domati, what are they saying as far as, I know there's more demonstrations planned for tomorrow, and I think they're going to continue something at the courthouse as well. Are you getting any indication of if these are going to be coordinated kind of across the city in different areas? I also heard there was a gathering in Humboldt Park, too. So, but are there going to be kind of coordinated gatherings until the verdict is read, and then one big demonstration like in a centralized location? Or what are you hearing as far as staging for the next couple of days?
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do, especially William Calloway. He's trying to coordinate all of these efforts, and different activist groups are trying to coalesce under this umbrella. There's one group, the Alliance Against Racial and Political Oppression, I believe it's called. I may have some of the acronym mixed up, but it's a cadre of organizations, a group that serves kind of like an umbrella organization over all of these organizations so that their actions can be, you know, coordinated. The problem with that is, as you know, we saw with the Father Flager protest later on, followed by the Reverend Gregory Livingston protest and the activist community in Chicago, everyone has different thoughts, different agenda, and different ways and methods of moving around. So you know that their effort is to put together marches at City Hall. They want to march, bring the march downtown. They want to march in the Loop. They want to go areas away from the neighborhood so that we don't have a situation where they're burning down their own communities, but that they're peacefully marching in areas where legislators pay attention. But you also have other activist groups who the media may not know so well who are going to have their one-off protests as well.
Do you have any sense, because people are wondering about the marathon this weekend. We actually have a texter who's asking about that. I'll be running the marathon this weekend. And is the city saying anything about safety for the runners and spectators? Do you have any? Have you heard any word about disrupting the marathon?
I haven't heard any word yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if it happened. I actually was talking to some folks about that, and they were pretty elusive with giving me that information. So hopefully I find out more about what they plan to do this weekend so we can have the heads up at least. But I know the Chicago Police Department is certainly beefing up security to make sure that isn't disrupted.
Keep us posted, yeah. Domati, because I'm covering the marathon for TV and Eric is supposed to be covering the protest on Sunday. So we're going to kind of tag team it.
Yeah, you're talking a million people in downtown Chicago on Sunday.
Yeah.
Domati, if you don't mind,
maybe
we can check in with you tomorrow night after the game if you're still up for it. I know that you've got a long weekend ahead of you, but if you don't mind, we'd like to check in again.
I'd love to. I don't plan on sleeping this weekend. So
thanks, Domati.
Right. I haven't slept in 2.5 weeks, Domati, so we're in good company.
Thanks, Domati.
You guys can share the couch in the newsroom. All right, Domati. Yeah, it is a big couch. Big. They can cuddle. I made it weird. All right. Thanks, Domati. Have a good night. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'll cuddle with you guys tomorrow night.
All right.
We all need some cuddling now.
I know. Would you cuddle with me?
It's been in a tense couple of weeks, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm gonna go cuddle in my office by myself in a minute. Just because HR said to. More after this on WGN 720. There's something I've been wanting to talk about for the last couple days. And what was it like to be in the courtroom when Jason Van Dyke took the stand? It's the Patty Vasquez Show with Andrea Darlis. And Eric Rung was there. He was a couple rows back behind the prosecution's table.
Yep.
And people saw you. We saw you on TV. And I was like, I got to talk to him. And so now you've had some time to process it. All the energy. I'm sure that this is also crystal clear in your mind. First of all, when you heard that they were that he was going to take the stand, what did the courtroom even seem like? I mean, because I thought he should.
There's a lot of people that thought he should. I remember talking to Joe Roddy, and he was telling me, he was a former prosecutor. He told me, he said, the defense that they're putting on, he has to take the stand because his whole case rests on what he perceived as being a threat. So, and there had been whispers about it throughout the courthouse for the week prior, actually, that he was going to take the stand. It was always just kind of win. But you could really see the strategy that the defense put on there, because the first person they put on before Van Dyke was the psychologist. And he talked about how that when people are involved in dangerous situations, that their brains kind of put memory building on hold. They kind of suppress that because your brain is trying to figure out, how do I get out of this danger? How do I protect myself? How do I protect these other people? So that's why you may not remember exactly as things happened that night. You may have a different perception. Right. Time was slow. You had tunnel vision, didn't hear everything. And then right after that is when they put Van Dyke on. And everybody was a little surprised that they put him on so early. We figured if they were going to put him on, he was going to be the last witness for the defense.
Really? Okay.
But that wasn't the case. And you could see now it's clear with 2020 hindsight why they did it the way they did it, is because the psychologist got up and talked about how, you know, people involved in these situations don't remember things exactly the way they may seem. And of course, we all have the videotape that shows what happened that night. Maybe not directly from his perspective, but it gives us a really good idea. And so the prosecution or the defense had him go through it, had him go through the video, tell him what they saw or what he saw with Laquan McDonald. He talked about this teenager that was whacked out, had bugged eyes, and was staring at him and turned his torso toward him and the knife up and pointed it at him. And that's when he fired the shots. He said he could see into the soul of Laquan McDonald.
Oh, I've missed that part where he said he could see into the soul of Laquan McDonald.
Yeah.
I want to ask, too, about that and then the PCP, you know, Laquan McDonald, you know, the drugs that were in his system. But I'm curious, when we were watching it, I mean, because we were texting Penny, you and I, during the trial, and I mean, glued to it, and you're in the courtroom, and Jason Van Dyke, and I think this might have been methodical, how he made these big, long pauses before he answered.
Oh, he got emotional, too. Yeah.
And he got emotional and stuff. I guess I'm curious how that was perceived by the jury. Did they lean in, or did they show any emotion at all?
This jury has not shown emotion at all throughout the entire trial. They really didn't show anything. I mean, you could tell when there were some exchanges between either the prosecution or the defense attorneys and a witness, they would kind of peek their heads up. But for the most part, they kept a straight face. They kept their heads in their notebook. They took a lot of notes. Some took pages after pages of notes while others were...
That'd be me. I take notes on everything.
Well, I'm the same way.
Oh, my God.
Well, usually in cases like this, and I've noticed this about juries, is usually the first couple of days, they're almost writing down every single word. And as the trial continues, they write less and less. But I would say it was pretty consistent throughout this trial. The ones that were taking notes were taking notes. What was also interesting, though, especially when Van Dyke took the stand, and I had to remember to get myself out of tunnel vision while I was in there because I was so focused on what he was saying and wanted to make sure that I got everything right and taking good notes, that I would look around and I would look at the jury to see how they were taking in some of this stuff. And then I would turn around and I would look at Van Dyke's wife, who was sitting just a row behind me, and she was holding the hand of another family member. They had the nun from their parish there. She was saying the rosary out loud during his testimony. And then you also saw Laquan McDonald's uncle, great uncle, that was in there. And during one of the breaks when Van Dyke was on the stand, Laquan McDonald's mother did get up and leave, and she didn't return.
Okay.
And the great uncle who's been talking to the media throughout this entire case so far said, you know, it was just too much for him.
I would imagine.
And Van Dyke got emotional too when he was talking about going through that night and reliving it. He got choked up. He wiped away tears.
Was it hard to hear in the courtroom because he kept asking the prosecutor, and again, maybe this was methodical on...
To slow everything down.
To slow the proceedings down so he could get his thought. I mean, it is intimidating to testify for anybody.
Right.
Was it hard to hear because he kept saying, I'm sorry, can you repeat that, miss?
Well, I think he was buying time.
Okay.
I mean, it looked like a stall tactic to me. You know, maybe he just didn't hear, or maybe just wanted to make sure that he got it exactly right.
Right.
Now, one thing that I have heard throughout the courtroom, too, or courthouse, I should say, from several different people, attorneys and whatnot, is that they thought the prosecution didn't go hard enough on him. Mm. That they almost had Van Dyke on the ropes a couple of times.
And then she just stopped all of a sudden.
Yeah, and then took a step back.
Right.
And so people were a little curious about that. But I think they did today on their closing arguments. They went strong and they went hard.
Well, especially when she got him to say that he was shooting at the knife and no longer what his training sort of supports, which is center mass.
Right.
He said he was trying to shoot the knife out of his hand.
Right.
And which is an interesting thing for him to say. That was the first time I'd ever heard anything like that.
It's the first time I think anybody had heard that. And the other thing that she asked him is, you say that he turned to you and he raised his arm and he pointed at you. Yes, that's what I saw. Why don't we see any of that on the videotape? Why don't we see any of that even on the animation that your defense attorneys paid for to have made to show your perspective? And then he said, and I thought this was interesting too, he said, well, that really wasn't my perspective either.
Right, because it's behind his head, he said.
It was behind his head.
Yeah, exactly.
But then at the same time, though, that animation, one thing it did do is it showed the distance between the two, and it showed that Laquan McDonald, while it may appear and does look like he is veering away from him, that he was still closing the distance between the two. But it didn't account, I don't think, for Van Dyke taking two steps toward Laquan McDonald either when he got out of the squad car.
So Jason Van Dyke's defense, of course, and you alluded to it earlier, Eric, is when he said he locked eyes with Laquan McDonald and saw through his soul. He locked eyes. That's the moment where he feared for his life and started firing the weapon, which was interesting to me because the juror who was dismissed today, the female who said she would have voted guilty, said that she didn't buy the argument that Laquan McDonald was on PCP and was high at the time. This is her view and her opinion. She was an alternate. She was dismissed, so she's not voting. But she said that she didn't think anything Laquan McDonald's mental state or anything he had done before, including being high on PCP, should have had anything to do with him being shot. So my question to you, Eric, is today during their closings, did they hammer that home? Like, did they really push that? Hey,
oh,
this
they
guy
pushed
was
PCP.
High.
Yeah, they did.
Oh,
PCP.
They've pushed.
So I'm just curious why. I mean, if that's the whole defense, that the juror, this particular juror, didn't want to have anything to do with that theory, which is kind of the whole basis for the defense.
Well, the defense, since day one, they've put Laquan McDonald on trial and shown how he was this dangerous teenager out to, you know, cause all kinds of problems around the city.
Right, which would, I guess, speak to his mental state, too, because if you're arriving at a scene knowing that this person had been either slashing tires or 911 had been called on him and that his mental state, you know, that he was high, You know, I'm just curious as to why they wouldn't take that into account.
Well, I don't think it ever came over the radio transmissions that he was high. I think the only thing that came over the radio transmissions was that he had punctured the tire and tried to hit the windshield with the knife.
Got it.
And see, and this was also the interesting thing that came out from the prosecution, and they hammered this home in the closing arguments today, too, is they used some of Van Dyke's own words against him, knowing that he didn't know that he had almost tried to stab the truck driver when he was caught stealing radios and what have you, that once he heard that radio transmission that Laquan McDonald had punctured the tire, he had said to his partner, "Why aren't they shooting him?" And as more radio transmissions came in, he even said, "Oh my gosh, we're going to have to shoot him." And that was prior to he hadn't seen him yet.
He hadn't seen him yet.
And so the prosecution said Laquan McDonald never had a chance because he had already thought about what he was going to do when he confronted the teenager. Now, the defense would argue that that's
right,
not the case at
exactly,
all, and
yeah.
And you know he got out of the car and saw the threat.
Right.
Look, and I know this, a lot of this has to do with training and adrenaline from the 815. How many seconds did his gun take to fire those shots? I feel for this guy. Adrenaline works to allow us to survive. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to look at this story, and now it rests with the jury. It's you know, we can judge all we want based on the videos.
And we can guess all we want,
yes,
too.
But,
I mean, we just don't know.
It's now in the hands of the jury. I want to thank you so much for all your coverage.
Absolutely.
Eric. Get some rest. We'll try to check in with you again.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, please get some rest.
Yeah. Busy weekend.
Do I look that bad?
No, I just know how hard you've been working.
Good thing we're on the radio.
You look great. I'm astounded by how great you look. I just mean I know that you've been working really hard, and I want you to take care of yourself.
You.
I want you to get ahead of not looking good. How's that?
Yeah. All right. I like
That's
it.
Yeah.
I like
you,
it.
Eric.
Have
a great
anytime,
job.
Guys.
Great
anytime.
Job.
Thank you so much for Bye-bye. Joining us. More in a moment on 720 WGN. Throughout the Jason Van Dyke trial, WGN Radio and CLTV have been live streaming it. Andrea Darlis and I have been following it as well. I know Michael Heidemann has been checking in with the story, but there are a few people as close to this as far as in our family as Doma T. Pongo, who we checked in with. We had Eric Rung, who was in the courtroom, and also joining us on the line is Rich Lenkov, who co-hosts Legal Face-Off with Tina Martini, which you can find every week on WGNplus.com. And he's also, I heard this earlier on Rokan's show, so I'm not sure if I'm supposed to legally say he's with Bryce Downey and Lenkov LLC, but I'll go ahead and use that as well, Rich.
If you don't mention the LLC, I'm going after Heidemann, like, right away, so it's probably a good idea that you are.
There you go. Perfect. So you have, how many days have you spent in the courtroom or close to the courtroom?
Well, today was my first day, actually. I've been trying to get over there, but someone named Rung took my pass every day, so.
Uh-oh. That guy.
You know, there's only so many to go around. But, yeah, no, today was my first day, but obviously watching it almost every day. But, yeah, today was my first day, actually, in court.
Well, what has struck you? Let's start with you know, obviously, first the prosecution presents their case. They called several officers who were on the scene. They called, you know, ballistic experts. They called a coroner. What were some of the elements of the prosecution's case that really stuck out for you?
Well, I think one of the effective things, and you heard it today, was the element of time, right? We heard the prosecutor state in her closing of all the options that Van Dyke had, including, you know, time. I think that was fairly effective. On the other hand, you know, I think that somewhat conflicts with what we saw in the video. The state was trying to show, and they argued today, one of their, you know, the central components of their argument today was that Van Dyke had several other options, right? He could have boxed him in, he could have bumped Laquan McDonald with his car, he could have used the taser, waited for the taser, he could have retreated to his car, all these other options. I think right. That was an effective argument to show that what he did was unreasonable. But I do think it conflicts with what you saw in the video. And, you know, Van Dyke referenced this a little bit, I think very inartfully and not very articulately, but I think he did mention that, you know, it happened very quickly. And if you look at the video, for example, if you take the boxing in idea, I mean, there's no way he could have retreated back to his car, set up this tactical maneuver in his vehicle, you know, coordinated with the other vehicles on the scene. That's just, I don't think that would have been reasonable given the quickness of what happened on the video. So, yeah, you know, on the one hand, I think that was fairly effective, but I do think, you know, that the jury is going to be looking at that hard over the next day or so, however long they deliberate, and I think there is some inconsistency there.
Rich, WGN-TV talked tonight, and I think some of the other media outlets did as well, with some of the alternate jurors who were dismissed. And I want to ask you about that. Two definitely said they would have voted guilty. Now,
yes,
I didn't hear what the others said, but the two that I listened to said that they would have found him guilty for various reasons or for different reasons. But I guess as us watching that, again, I know we're all armchair quarterbacking this. We're not the jury. We're not the ones deciding. We're not the ones who have all of our time invested in this as far as being in the courtroom and listening to all the evidence verbatim. But what can we take away from the alternate juror's response? Should that be any indication of how the others are feeling, or absolutely not? Complete opposite.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, they're a pretty good preview of what the jury is thinking, right? I mean, they were there. They are in the shoes of the jurors, even though they were alternates. I think that they, you know, they're alternates for a reason. If there's any issue with the jury, they step in. So the fact that the two that we heard from said they would have voted guilty, now, I don't think they specified whether they were going to vote, you know, guilty and then to lesser charge of second degree or what, but the fact that they both said that they were going to vote guilty, I think, is a pretty accurate preview of what the jury is thinking. Now, again, you know, they are not going through the deliberations, to your point. You know, there's a reason that there is a sequestering. There's a reason that there's a deliberation process. So the fact that their gut reaction is guilty doesn't mean that the jury will come back guilty, right? I mean, we've all seen many examples of trials where you hear from jurors that their initial gut was one thing and they deliberated and came to another. So, while I think it's an accurate, you know, feeling of what the rest of the jurors are thinking, I don't know that it previews exactly what will happen.
How much does the offer to consider second-degree murder change those deliberations today?
Oh, that's huge. I mean, I think everyone agrees that that is an incredible development. I think that it allows the jury to come up with a compromise that they would not otherwise have. You know, it's incredibly historic that to convict a police officer of first-degree murder would be an incredible statement, would be incredibly difficult, I think, for anyone to do. Not that they won't do that, not that it's impossible, not that the evidence doesn't, you know, necessarily support that, but to give them a credible alternative, a compromise that accomplishes the goal of punishing him and giving Van Dyke real jail time while not putting him in jail for 22 life, I think is a really powerful development.
Rich, based on your experiences from jurors that you have polled over your career, what's the first thing that they would do? Would they go in, Patty and I were trying to figure this out earlier, would they immediately say, let's take a vote on first degree, let's take a vote on second degree? And I know you're speculating, but what do you think their movements were?
Yeah, generally, no, you're absolutely right. Generally, they will take, you know, an initial vote. They'll see if there's a consensus, and then it goes from there. I mean, if there is a consensus and there is 12 people who agree, then, you know, it's a pretty quick development. But generally, you'll have the initial vote. There'll be some disagreement, and then, you know, off you go from there. But, yeah, I think the first thing they do when they get back there after determining who the four person is they do a quick vote.
So we're 5 hours into the deliberations. I know, again, everybody always says, oh, if it's quick, it's guilty. I know you can never really judge, but we're 5 hours in. Do you anticipate, again, best guess, this coming back sooner, or are we going to be here for another week?
I think, I mean, I told Ro and Anna earlier that I think it's going to be tomorrow. I mean, that might be, you know, for a couple reasons, I think that is accurate. I mean, you know, Columbus Day is Monday. I wouldn't want to be in a motel somewhere, you know, on Columbus Day. Not that that is going to be the overriding factor, but these are human beings who have been sitting there for 3 weeks. I mean, not that that's the longest criminal trial in history, but, you know, would any one of us want to be doing that for 3 weeks? No. And I honestly think that, you know, it's a fairly simple issue. I don't say that as a means to oversimplify the importance of it, but, you know, this is not a trial involving hundreds of pieces of evidence and, you know, dozens of witnesses. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward issue. And, you know, not the least of which reason is because there's the video. I mean, at the end of the day, the video really tells a lot of the story of the case, and either you believe that the video supports one side or the other. So I don't know. From my perspective, I think it's a fairly straightforward issue, and I feel like the trial moved fairly quickly. My gut tells me that they're going to come up with a quick decision, but, you know, to your point, who knows? You really have no idea what they're thinking or what's going on in that room.
Rich, there's a listener who wonders in regards to the alternate jurors making comments. Can that be used as a grounds for mistrial, or because they've been dismissed and the jury has been sequestered, it really has no effect?
Yeah, they're done. I mean, once they're done, they're done. That's why, you know, when you speak to a juror, when you poll a jury afterwards, that's perfectly, you know, acceptable. They're done. I mean, they're free to, you know, do what they want. In some circumstances, you know, there are limits as to whether they can write a book or profit from it. But, yeah, I mean, the jury system is such that once you are discharged, you are free to do what you want.
And the other question somebody, I don't know if this isn't really a question, it's more of an observation. I'm wondering what your take was on the prosecutors. The 312 says they had to go to another county, Kane County, to get special prosecutors, and this was the best they could get. I've been a trial lawyer for 30-plus years, and these two reminded me of Marsha Clark and Chris Darden in the OJ case.
So I hate to, you know, listen, as a professional and as a legal analyst, I hate to criticize others, but I feel like I have to in this case, and I agree with your caller, and I agree with what you said earlier. I really was surprised by the cross. I mean, you said earlier, Patty, that they went light on him. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I've seen attorneys. I do a lot of civil law and a lot of, you know, I do a lot of complex work too, but I also do a lot of basic, you know, one plaintiff versus one defendant. I've seen lawyers that are killers in those kind of cases, and this is, you know, again, one of the biggest trials in the history of Chicago, how you don't bring your A game, how you don't come out swinging. And, you know, there were so many opportunities to go after Van Dyke, and they just stopped. I mean, you all talked about it earlier with Eric that they just let him off the hook.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not even, you don't even have to know the ins and outs of this case. It's basic criminal procedure. It's like things you learn in law school. If someone is not answering the question, which he was doing all day, you know, on Thursday, you go after him, or on Wednesday, whenever he testifies, you go after him. I mean, that's a perfect chance to go after him, and don't let him off the hook. To my mind, he was controlling the dynamic of that testimony. Eric pointed out earlier, and we all saw how many pauses he had. Mm-hmm. Listen, those are basic tricks that any, you know, attorney teaches their clients. The reason that he was pausing was because he was trying to throw her off, and he did. You know, listen, any human being, if you have to ask the same question three times, you think the third time is going to be as effective as the first time? Of course not. She came in, you know, she had her first question was her strongest. If I tell you, oh, I don't understand, you have to repeat it three times, it's like, you know, you're photocopying a photocopy, right?
Yes.
That third copy is going to be terrible.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was just, you know, my personal opinion, because it seems as though she stopped in mid-sentence when she stopped asking him questions.
He threw her off completely. I mean, you know, and the pauses, I mean, one practical reason why I tell my clients to pause, and any attorney does, is because you want to let an objection jump in. I mean, you know, the way I tell my clients is you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, even though if you answer a question and then I object, the judge can say to the jury, disregard what he said. It's too late. You've answered it. So Van Dyke did a very effective job in pausing. That allowed, even though Herbert didn't really object too much, it gives your attorney a chance to object without your answer being, you know, out there in the ether. So I thought Van Dyke, even though I really think he was not credible, because I thought there were so many instances where he came across as robotic and avoiding the answer, I really think he won that exchange.
Rich, in the opening statements, the prosecution brought up race, and that was one of the last times I heard it brought up. I expected to hear a little bit more about that, but it seemed to not play toward their argument. Roe actually had on Jason Van Dyke's brother-in-law, who's African-American, and said he's not a racist, he's a great guy, he's a guy everybody wants to be around. I was surprised he didn't take the stand, because he would have been, to me, a good character witness for him. But were you surprised they didn't play that angle a little more?
A little bit. I mean, we actually, you and I, we all talked about that last time. Yeah. I was on. Yeah, I was a little surprised. I mean, certainly that issue is out there, and you know, we see the protests, and we see his great uncle. I mean, it's obviously an issue. You know, when I walked out of WGN earlier today, you know, there was probably 100 police on, you know, horseback, lining Wacker Drive. That wouldn't happen, I don't think, in a trial where race wasn't an issue. That being said, you know, as a prosecutor, you have to decide whether you're going to go that way, because once you open that door, you can't close it, right? And then the whole trial, I think, becomes about race. I think the prosecution felt like they had enough evidence in this case to not raise that. Yeah, I thought it was going to be more of an issue, but I'm not totally surprised that they didn't go that way.
We need to take a quick break and then do a couple minutes with you, if you don't mind, about
sure.
the pending vote to get Judge Kavanaugh out of the Judiciary Committee and into the Senate for his confirmation in the Supreme Court. So hold on. We are hanging out with Rich Lenkoff. He co-hosts the Legal Face-Off with Tina Martini, and obviously regular contributor here at WGN Radio. More in a moment on 720 WGN. The FBI has submitted their report after the pause button was hit by Senator Flake and Senator Coons last week during the Judiciary Committee hearings. And I wanted to see what Rich Lenkoff thought. You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show with Andre Darlis. And Rich, did you see the piece that Judge Kavanaugh wrote today saying, "That's not me, I was really upset. Yeah, I'm going to be very impartial."
Yeah, I was a little emotional during my hearings. Do you think, Judge? Do you think you were maybe a little bit out of line? I mean, I don't buy it. You know, I thought his performance was ridiculous, and I mean, in and of itself, I think would be a disqualifier for the Supreme Court. So now his backtracking in light of, you know, the massive outpouring of, you know, negativity over his testimony, I think it's too late. I think he showed his true colors. So I saw the piece, I read it, and I dismiss it. I think he'll be that way on the court, and I worry for the future of the Supreme Court.
So it sounds as though you believe he will be confirmed.
Oh, no question. I mean, I think that ship has sailed. I don't think he should be. You know, I think I agree with – I don't know who's telling the truth, but I think, like anything, I interview – many people, and have hundreds, you know, interviewed hundreds of people and hired dozens of them. And, you know, if someone came in and I was suspicious of them being abusive or raping or, you know, over drinking, that would be enough, right? And that's an employee. That's not one of the 9 most important legal people in the world. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I think he's got the votes. I think it's all, you know, it's all reduced to politics, and I think it'll be confirmed.
I agree with you, Rich, and it is unfortunate because, you know, you are talking about a sexual assault allegation, not from one, not from two, not multiple women now coming forward. And that's what's troubling, is that all the other nominees, John Edwards, Neil Gorsuch, whoever, it's always going to fall along party lines. You're not going to agree with their politics. That's fine. But this is almost like a game changer. Do you recall anything like this? Again, not things will fall along party lines, but this is such a game changer. Mm-hmm. I mean, this should be women, men, Democrat, Republican, independents should all be saying, wait a minute. You know, this is a serious allegation.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we all believe in due process. We all believe in presumption of innocence. But by the same token, there's enough there to at least disqualify. I mean, why even go into a lifetime appointment for someone who will be on a court for 30 or even 40 years with this doubt? I mean, that doesn't help anyone. Just, you know, there's plenty of other qualified candidates who aren't being accused of rape. I mean, there's dozens, if not hundreds, of people who could fill that job capably and actually would be a bigger asset for Trump, you know, because they're more conservative, they're younger. We talked last time I was on about Amy Barracone. She's, you know, almost 10 years younger, and she's far more conservative, and she would sail through the confirmation process. But, you know, Trump is so stubborn, and, you know, he just wants to put on this guy and stick with him. I think it's ridiculous, but you know, that's the world we're living in.
I was struck by something today as I was reading more about Lindsey Graham, and of course that moment on the at the hearings where he basically threw down the gauntlet and rallied the rest of the Republicans behind him, and that was when things really turned around. And it struck me that when people talk about how powerful Michael Madigan is in the state of Illinois, I realize that Lindsey Graham holds a lot of power over Americans in this position he has in the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if that's something that people have thought about. I mean, people are always like, we should get rid of Michael Madigan. Well, the people in his district vote for him, and this is the way it works. You know, and the people in Lindsey Graham's district vote for him, and this is the way it works.
He does. I mean, you know, the Republicans have the majority in the Senate. They have the majority on the Judiciary Committee. Mitch McConnell, you know, is incredibly loyal. I mean, as they all are, you can't, on the one hand, you can't fault the Republicans for doing what they're doing because that's the way they all are. I mean, they don't care, I think, about what's right or wrong. The Democrats, unfortunately, would be doing the same thing if they were in the majority and it was someone that was on the other side. I mean, I think the unfortunate reality of this is that it just goes down party lines regardless of what's right or wrong. I think objectively, this person should not be on the court given the allegations of what we heard. We're not talking about a Bork situation. You know, Bork was rejected because of his views. That is different from the situation here where you've got, you know, tons of credible evidence that this person committed, you know, acts that should disqualify him from the court.
I want to thank you so much for your time, Rich, and obviously we'll know more possibly tomorrow and in the week to come. But we'll keep in touch and catch up with you again. And everyone can check out Legal Face Off, available on WGNplus.com, that Rich co-hosts with Tina Martini. Thank you, Rich.
Thanks very much. Appreciate
Hi, Rich.
It.
Get some rest, Bye. Will you? I know it's going to be a long weekend. I'll talk to you later. More after this on 720 WGN. Andrea, you know, I'm very public about the services that we have available for my son, Declan, who struggles with intellectual disabilities and physical disabilities and challenges.
Yes.
And I'm always grateful for programs, schools, educators, medical providers who are really dedicated to making the lives of families like mine easier and better and helping children reach their potential. And one such group is our good friends at Giant Steps, and they have a walk coming up. We're on the phone with Janelle Flurkey, and we want to welcome you. Hi, Janelle. How are you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Very well. Tell us a little bit about what do you do for Giant Steps?
Basically, I am a resource out there to share the good news about what's going on with Giant Steps out to the community, making sure families like you have things that they can get a hold of and provide as a resource. And then also plan special events so that we can raise some extra funds to help the individuals that are part of the school at Giant Steps. We serve more than just the child. We serve the whole family. So we're here to do enrichment and provide an educational resource.
What ages do you start at? Do you have a preschool program for kids?
We start at kindergarten.
Kindergarten,
so,
okay.
Yes, we do start at kindergarten, and we provide what we need to make sure that those youngsters have the best resource they can have for being autistic and on the spectrum.
That's such a wonderful venue, too. I love Rich Harvest Farms, and I think it's so cool that after the walk, the stables will be open?
Yeah, this year is just
great.
Such a special treat. The walk is going to be an amazing event, but right after the walk, we will have a stable open house. And the stables is actually where we do our equestrian program for individuals on the spectrum. Our older individuals that are part of our canopy program are actually out there 3 times a week.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's so awesome.
My son benefits from hippotherapy. For those who don't know, it is equine therapy, maybe a better way to explain it. But do you find, as we do, that so many of the youngsters and as they get to be adults really do benefit from that, one, the connection with the horse, but also the physicality of it as well?
You're exactly right on, and sometimes it can take just a matter of one session, and sometimes it can take weeks, but it's more than just a connection. You see so many milestones that happen because of the characteristics that occur through that equestrian program. Again, sometimes it's just an instant where that individual has a direct correlation, and they come alive through their body language, but other times it does take a little bit of time.
Sure.
And at Giant Steps, through our program, it's not just about the riding. It's about the caregiving, understanding what the animal is that they're working with, and making sure they understand that there's a holistic need there to cleaning the stalls, to cleaning things, and then actually the characteristic of riding.
Yeah, Declan, when he's done riding, so he walks the horse back to his paddock, to his own little stall.
Nice.
And he closes the gate because Declan's very, he needs hand-over-hand direction. So he needs to sort of be walked through that. But he goes through the whole routine. He feeds the horse a carrot through the slot. And then he touches the horse. I'm the nose. It's like all part of the routine of working with the horses. And it's really is such a wonderful thing. I mean, obviously, everybody connects differently at different stages. So I'm so glad you guys do that as part of the program. How long ago did that start with Giant Steps?
The equestrian program and then the program through the Canopy program at Rich Harvest Farm. That's been going on probably for about a year and a half.
I thought it might be new.
But this year it is completely full force. Like I said, the individuals from Giant Steps are out there through our rec program one day a week. And then our Canopy individuals are actually out there 3 days a week, spending a good couple of hours and really getting to have a huge benefit into that program, because those are individuals that we'd like to see out in the community someday doing some type of job skills or some type of enrichment so they have some amazing quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, we're still able to donate, or if we have to say work, or sponsor walkers, right? I mean, you'll always accept donations,
yes,
too. Awesome.
We always do accept donations. The website is open, and that is walk.gssteps.org. Again, our walk is one of two special events that we have each year to raise the extra funds for Giant Steps, so we can provide those services and be a great resource, like I said, not only to the students, not only to the individuals at our school, but the whole family.
I love that. And again, we're talking to Janelle Florkey. She's the development manager at Giant Steps. Their walk is this Saturday, October 6th. And it's the 5K walk for autism, which starts at 10 a.m. The open house starts afterwards at 11:30. And tell us a little bit about this relationship you guys have built with Rich Farms, because this has had a significant impact, I think, on the expansion of the programs you have, hasn't it?
Yes, you're exactly right. Rich Harvest Farms is a huge benefactor of ours. They help us make the magic of serving the needs of these individuals on the spectrum come alive. It compares to really nothing else. We have the full realm to providing things through the magic of all these acreage, the golf course, all the resources that they provide us. There's nothing that could really match it. But they sometimes roll out the red carpet for our individuals and have such a passion.
They do a great job, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I also want to congratulate you guys for acknowledging that some of us don't want to do a 5K. Maybe we want to do a little bit shorter.
Yeah.
So you guys, you have a one-mile path as well involved in the walk, don't you?
We sure do. And that's where, again, we want to reach the needs of everyone that is coming to our event, because we understand sometimes you as families, having an individual on the spectrum, sometimes these things can be difficult. You know, going out in the public or doing things like this, you don't really know when something's going to occur, a crisis might occur, or just something. But we do want you to come out. We do want to make the right steps so that you can be a part of this walk and walk for Giant Steps.
Working with the families, are you getting the sense that it's getting easier for families like ours? Because I refuse to hide. You know, a lot of families do because they know that their kids are going to be disruptive. If they go to a restaurant, it's very hard to do the things that you might do with a typically developing child. Are you finding that there's more acceptance and at least easier to go out and enjoy themselves as a family?
You know what? I feel like there is beginning to be more of that. But here at Giant Steps, we are providing that resource. We want to provide the steps to make sure families don't continue hide. It's not fair. You are an individual just like everyone else. You deserve everything. So we do want to make sure that that happens for our families. And they do that Monday through Friday when they're working with the individuals to, you know, bring their body back down to where it needs to be and have coaching moments so that the individual can enjoy these events just like Sam and Billy of any other family.
Right. Yeah. That's really any family's hope. So the walk again is this Saturday, October 6th, beginning at 10 a.m. The stable open house is at 11:30. The Rich Harvest Farm is at 75. These are so many numbers. 75771 Dugan Road, Sugar Grove. And you can go to www.campaigns.mygiantsteps.org/walk2018. What's the website for the organization for Giant Steps, My Giant Steps?
My Giant Steps is just www.mygiantsteps.org.
And I just want people to know that this isn't the only time you can get involved. If maybe you're not able to make it on Saturday, the website often has ways for you to volunteer, to donate. Is that accurate, Janelle?
That is correct. Yep, it's ongoing. We always have something out there to make sure we can be a resource again to the entire family. And not just families at Giant Steps, families, you know, out in the community that has an autistic individual or want to understand how they can learn to give back more.
It's so important. I think people want to find ways to help. Well, before we go, I want to find out, how did you get involved with My Giant Steps?
I have a passion to helping individuals with special needs. I actually have a degree in special education, but wanted to do more to help more people than just the students in front of me. And really early on in my career, felt like I enjoyed reaching out in the community, proclaiming missions and getting things going. And working with the outside to make the inside could be what it needed to be.
I love that. Awesome. I love that you found something you're passionate about. Everyone go to mygiantsteps.org for more information on this incredible school and all the great events that they have, the programs that they have, not just for the students there, but in the community as well. Thank you so much, Janelle. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thanks, you too.
Janelle.
Thank you. Thank you. More after this on 720 WGN. Funny. I was just reading something, Andrea, and I was like, I was going to ask you something, and you're like, I have to ask you something. So you ask me something.
Okay, I'm going to ask you something. This is completely off point and off topic, but do you take your shoes off in your house?
Yes.
Does your family?
Yes.
Do you make guests or friends
No.
who come over? Okay.
You know why?
Why?
Because I'm afraid that they'll feel how dirty my floors are.
Is that the only reason?
Yes.
Come on, for real?
No, I mean, but most people see our entire pile of shoes and they know to take their shoes off. Yeah, we have mats both outside the door and inside the door. I try to keep, because we all have I obviously have a lot of shoes.
Right.
But I try to keep the clutter down as much as I can. We have a very small space. Why do you ask? Do you take your shoes off?
Here's why I ask. I always, so when I, you know, my growing up, I always, you know, we would come in the house. My mom would always make us take our shoes off. And we all did. Everybody did. Guests, not so much, and it's funny because my mom will take her shoes off in her house,
right?
And if she goes to someone else's house and keeps them on, she's like, oh, well, you know, so-and-so made me take my shoes off. And I went, yes, but you do the same thing. So she wants to keep her shoes on at other people's house, whereas if I went to your house, I would automatically take my shoes off. Even if you said, no, keep them on, it's okay. I just would do it. So I had a friend come over today, and he just stopped by briefly, and he came inside and he said, oh, can I use your bathroom? I went, yeah, of course, my gosh. And you know, he's a guy and he's in gym shoes, not that, you know, I shouldn't generalize, I'm sorry.
Did you cringe a little bit though?
I did. I went, yeah, oh god. And he's such a good friend. I could have easily been like, come on, man, take your shoes off, and he would have been like, oh, sorry. So it wouldn't have been a thing. But and I've known him 15 years, so it's not like we're not friends or he'd get mad at me, but I just felt funny saying, can you please take your shoes off? And I don't know why we have this, I have this fear of saying it to other people, but think about it. You know I'm a germaphobe.
I would not ask anyone to take their shoes off. I would never hesitate taking my shoes off at someone else's house.
Right.
If they ask me or other, if I see shoes, I'll take my shoes off.
Okay. But you wouldn't take offense if... I mean, I would let you wear your shoes in my house because I don't think I would say, please take your shoes off.
But you probably have mats with your shoes on, and I would see that and be like, oh, she's like me.
Yes.
I would take my shoes off.
Would you come in the back way or the front way?
Yes.
Yes. You'd see the shoes there.
Yeah. We're the same way. We have shoes on the back porch. We have shoes in the front door.
So you're not out of line if you say, oh, do you mind taking your shoes off?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I honestly don't think so. And the only reason I don't ask people to is because there's a lot going on my floor. There's a lot going on. Just like we were interviewing a woman to be a caregiver for Declan, and she was barefoot and she took her shoes off. I'm like,
I know.
I don't know if it's going to go because Declan like walks around like he doesn't like to sit down and eat. And he does once in a while, but he also like will walk and eat and like be done with something.
Food, yeah.
And he'll just drop like food all over. And we try to keep up with it.
Yes.
But you'll hear like you'll step on something and go, oh, Declan. And like
I
it's
miss
a crunch.
The ice cream cone. Yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah. It's always these rice and honey puffs.
Okay.
The cereal that he likes.
Oh, yeah. So they kind of crumble.
Yeah.
And there's like little
a lot
pieces of popcorn
everywhere. Yeah. And so I don't ask it. If people take them off. That's cool.
Right.
I cringe when they're barefoot.
I had the cable guy come over last Friday.
I cringe when they're barefoot because I know they'll feel it more and they'll be able to tell how sticky my floors are.
Yours is really just a precaution.
For them. I'm trying to protect them.
And I'm trying to protect my floor. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But gym shoes in my house, do make me crazy. Even my own.
Me too. It just, they pick up so much germs. I mean, think you're walking down the street, you're in a public bathroom.
Yes.
I mean, just think of where
bird
you
poop
stand.
Everywhere, rat droppings everywhere.
It's the city.
Gum, food.
Totally
all kinds of nasty in
totally
the city.
Agree.
Yes.
The cable guy came in last Friday and usually I will say, you know, if I have the exterminator or someone, they'll be like, oh, should I take my shoes off? Or they'll put the little booties on. I see a lot of, you know, servicemen and women doing that. They put the little booties on.
They look CSI.
Exactly. So I think that's kind of cool. Well, this guy came in and he could tell his boots were dirty. And as soon as he stepped in, I saw it, you know, on the dark hardwood floors and I went, oh God.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
But yet I didn't want to speak out and say anything.
Right.
So I was just, so I wouldn't be out of line.
You wouldn't be out of line. Maybe for workers, you might want to have your own collection of booties.
My own booties.
You might want to have your own booties. Right. Because here's the thing.
All right, I was just curious.
I have had people come in my house and actually say, this is in response to the 773, what if your guest is self-conscious about their stinky feet? And some people know that they can't
feet.
Be. Yeah.
Yes.
And so they don't want to take their shoes off. And so, like I said, I don't require that people take their shoes. My mom comes in my house with her shoes. I'm like, what are you doing? And she was always like, what? I'm like, we try not to wear our shoes in the house.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I'm like, we've been living here for 16 years, 17 years. And I felt badly. I mean, you don't want to make your mom take her shoes off
no,
either.
No, I know.
Do you remember that episode of Sex and the City?
Where her shoes were stolen?
Yes.
Yes, she
did not want to take off the shoes.
And they weren't things like expensive?
Yeah, Manolo.
Manolo Blahnik.
Yeah. And so she, do you remember how Carrie solved that problem? Because her shoes were stolen, and it was the little girl who she won the Academy Award when she was little, and now she's obviously an adult actress. She won it for Paper Moon with her dad, Ryan
Tatum O'Neal.
Thank you.
Yes,
I was getting there. I was backtracking.
You were
Tatum O'Neal.
I got your clues.
Yes, thank you. She was like, "Well, what's the big deal? You know, it was. You know, you don't have to. You're making a bigger deal than you need to." And it had been an engagement party, wasn't it? Where she bought gifts for her and everything.
And she was single, Carrie.
So she threw a party for herself and sent the invitation to Tatum and basically said, this is what I want, this is my registry, and it was just for the one pair of shoes.
Yeah, and she gave it to, she got them, right?
Yes.
That was great.
Yeah,
exactly. She guilted her.
It's funny because I don't know if I was single at the time, but it made sense because you do have all these friends who invite you to all these things and
totally
gifts are expected and you know, but that was like a level that I'm glad I've never been with people.
Oh yeah,
you know, where there's expectations. But anyway, back to you.
Okay, good.
You're right on all accounts. I could see being self-conscious. I could see wanting to ask people to take their shoes off, being hesitant.
Yeah.
And you need booties.
I need a supply of booties.
Do people often come in your house without taking their shoes off?
Not too often, no. Usually they know. You know, because just, I mean, I think we were all kind of, my family was raised this way. I think most people were like, you take your shoes off when you go to someone else's house.
Right. I always did. I remember my friend Sue will tell you that I would come over to her house and ask her if I could take my shoes off. I don't know why I would ask, or should I? I don't know. But I've always taken the worst.
I think you should ask, right? I mean, if you're in someone else's home and you're a guest in their home, you should say, oh, should I take my shoes off?
Right. Right. You should. Right. I would imagine, and especially if you see the shoes. Somebody from
the
301 says, I don't remember this being an issue when I was growing up, but my wife started taking her shoes off, taking your shoes off thing several years ago. Even our neighbor's children are now aware. In fact, one of them actually said to me one time, you're supposed to take your shoes off when you come into the house.
Oh, that's cute. The kids even know.
Yeah. And the
630
says, I cannot walk without my shoes on. Oh, interesting.
Oh, if it's a
orthopedic.
Medical,
or just support in general. Yeah, we're not
I'm sure you have.
We don't want to hurt anybody.
Just
bringing a lot of dirt in the house. More after this on 720 WGN. I got to find out if our next guest has people just going, oh, come on, it's going to be funny. Isn't it still going to be funny? We have on the line with us Murr from Impractical Jokers. His name is actually James S. Murray, and he has written a new book called Awakened. So seriously, do you want to be called James or Murr? What does everybody call you?
You guys can call me whatever you want. I'll take Murr. That's fine.
Murr. All right. It all works. So Andre Darlis, my co-host, and I were talking about your book off the air, and I don't know if Andre actually reads a lot of... Do you read horror stories, Andrea?
I don't read as much as I should. I used to read a ton.
This looks so good because yes. All I know, Murr, just the idea of a inaugural run of a train and it pulls into the station as everyone's waiting to celebrate and it's empty and drenched in blood. I'm in. I'm all in, my friend.
Monsters in the subway. You can't go wrong. Right. Come on.
You cannot. Well, who were some of the authors you grew up with? I know it sounds as though you've been wanting to do this for a while because I was a big Dean R. Koontz girl and obviously Stephen King.
Yeah, me too. I love Dean Koontz, love Stephen King. And I'm a huge movie buff too. I mean, the guys that I grew up watching all the classic, horrors like Nightmare on Elm Street
yes.
and Friday the 13th and The Descent and Aliens and movies like that. We're just huge fans of that genre. And so my whole life I've always wanted to write like a thrill, a novel, a thriller in particular. And, people ask me, they're like, Murr, you're a comedian, you're on Jokers. Why are you writing a horror? One could argue that what they do to me on Jokers is horror.
that is true.
I've had my nipples pierced. I've got a tattoo on my thigh. I've had my eyebrow shaved off on TV. These are terrifying things.
What of those has been the most horrifying for you?
Getting to meet my childhood crush, Danica McKellar, Winnie Cooper from The Wonder Years, and having to pose nude in front of her and do squats while greased up and spray tan, that was pretty tough.
Oh, man, you guys really know how to one-up it, don't you?
they give me the business, that's for sure.
They do give you the business. Well, tell us, before we talk more about your book, tell us a little bit more about Getting Started. I know that you were that your comedy troupe is Tenderloins, and this is something that you've been doing for, I'm guessing, most of your life now.
Yeah, well, the book and the guys and I have a similar story and past. We are high school friends. We met almost 30 years ago at this point. We became best friends. And we always wanted to do comedy together. We did comedy in high school together. So we formed our comedy troupe. But the thing is this, we're regular guys from Staten Island. We didn't know anybody in TV. We didn't have any cousin who worked in the business. We weren't cast. We didn't audition for something. We just worked really hard for a long time and failed a lot until we came up with the idea for Jokers and we sold it. And the book is the same path. I wrote the book 14 years ago.
Come on.
A full year of my life writing this action-packed, fast-paced, page-turning, kind of like pulse-pounding thriller called Awakened. At the end of the year, I didn't know anybody in publishing. So I just thought you send it into publishers, and with what have you. I sent it out to every publisher in New York, and get this, every single one returned it to me unopened. They wouldn't even open it to read it because I didn't have an agent or a lawyer or anything like that representing the project. And it sat there on my computer for 14 years
until
Jokers and our fan base. And 14 years later, I sent the exact same book in, and they bought the trilogy from me.
How many times did you change it?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what were the changes anybody requested?
Well, the cool thing about waiting 14 years was that Jokers came around. So I was able to go back into the book now, a year ago, and add in all sorts of little secret Joker Easter eggs throughout the book, for fans.
Oh, God.
Which is really cool,
That's a lot of fun. Yeah. And you just mentioned, you sold the trilogy. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, book two comes out in June of next year. Book three comes out in June 2020. We just announced the name of book two today, The Brink. It's the sequel to Awakened. It's pretty cool.
The Brink. By the way, we just got a text from the 773, which is a Chicagoland number, saying the book is so good.
Yes, I love it.
That's a fantastic. So first of all, I mean, obviously the subway system is just, such a great, ground and setting for something horrible. And because I mean, were you ever sitting on the train thinking, okay, what is it going to be? Is it going to be ghosts? Is it going to be aliens? Is it monsters? Because it really lends itself to that all the time.
Well, sure. And the other thing, too, is that, I mean, the New York City subway system is iconic. It's the oldest subway in the world. Everyone has an idea of what it's like. You know, they can, even if you're not from New York, you still have that sense of what it's like. You've seen it in the movies, that kind of claustrophobia you feel, the overcrowdedness, and also the creepiness when you're in a subway platform or in a car alone. So in the book, you know, they build this new subway line under the East River, and underneath the river itself, they build this gorgeous underwater visitor's pavilion. It's like glass and steel. It's the hub where all the trains meet underwater. And the inaugural run of the train, on the train itself is the mayor's wife and like 100 lucky New Yorkers. In the pavilion is the mayor, the president, press covering the event. When the train rolls into the underwater pavilion, all the passengers, including the mayor's wife, are gone. The cars have like a bloody crimson handprint on the wall, and the windows are shattered outward. So it's this great mystery, what happened. And what you come to learn and awaken very quickly is that what's secretly going on underneath New York City is far more terrifying than anything you'd ever imagined. It is the best summer beach reading you'll ever have in your life.
Who did it? Wait, don't tell me. Don't tell me.
it was Sal or Joe Q.
They were
in the book. I wrote them as characters in the book.
I love that.
Yeah. Oh, awesome.
Now, the other thing is basically with, you know, it seems as though if only they hadn't built this, you know, they hadn't sort of overstretched their abilities and dug deeper, perhaps they would not have awakened this beast.
You know, that could be part of the plot. It could be.
Was there? Oh.
You know, our hubris is our own downfall. It could be.
Exactly. Let's take a quick break here. I want to talk to you a little bit about about Darren Wearmouth as well, too.
Yeah.
Who is, you've written this with. Again, we're talking to James S. Murray, who has written Awakened with Darren Wearmouth, and he is a Murr from Impractical Jokers. More in just a moment. By the way, where should people go? Where would you like to send people to buy your book?
Any store will have it, or you can go to awakenednovel.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or anywhere books are sold online as well.
Excellent. Find Awakened anywhere books are sold. More in a moment on 720 WGN. There's something living beneath New York City, and it's not happy. We've woken it up. That's just part of the book cover. from Murr's new book, Awakened. It's Murr from Impractical Jokers. He's written the book Awakened, a novel. And you've teamed up with Darren Wearmouth. And I was just about to tell Andre that I was reading the book flap. So he was in the British Army for 6 years?
He was. He has a military background, and he's a best-selling author. And the cool thing is, like, you know, when it came time to polish the book up, you know, it would have taken like a month or two to do it on my own, but we filmed so many episodes of Jokers, I didn't have the time. So I said to the publisher, I was like, what do I do? They said, well, why don't we pair you up with like a best-selling author that can help you kind of whip it in shape and modernize it. And he is the loveliest man on the planet. He's a huge Jokers fan in the UK. We work really well together, and he's just an all-around nice guy. And together we kind of whip the book into shape, and obviously we're writing book 2 and 3 together from scratch. Even though book 1 was kind of already written. So it's been a really fun process. And he's just so lovely. And his accent is adorable. So,
I was going to ask you if that's why you thought he was lovely. Is it partly the accent?
The accent gets me every time. I'm a sucker for a good accent.
I have to agree. I was in London for a couple, in England for a couple weeks. And I have to say, from the Scottish, the Welsh, Irish, and the Brits, they, you know, right there in London, it is fun. And they could say anything and be charming.
That's true.
Well, and
they're smarter than we are too, generally. So, I try to partner up with people who are smarter than me.
So. Yeah. I don't know if that's I wouldn't go that far. I mean, not that I've spent that much time. By the way, I just have to say, because I'm sure you get people who like don't understand Impractical Jokers or why you guys kind of like are real. You have no shame, right? And I don't.
Yeah.
That's hard to explain
to
some people.
Well, we have a lot of shame. Joe's the only one who doesn't have shame.
Okay.
I'm ashamed often.
Are you?
on Jokers.
Well, because here's from the 630. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but getting your nipples pierced for a show or a play or a movie or whatever is disgusting. Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, you know, it's not my finest of moments.
Well, I mean,
you know, I have a question. Now,
yes.
Has there ever been a prank or a joke that has almost maybe broken up a friendship or...
I'll tell you the one that kind of pushed us to the edge. Well, two. One, they threw me out of an airplane, and I'm terrified of heights. That was tough.
Aww. With the parachute.
Yeah. I mean, they gave me a parachute. For
okay,
that.
Good. I was going to say, wait.
But, yeah. The second one was they shaved off my eyebrows.
Okay, that is dangerous.
It is dangerous.
They might not grow back. I know women who've done that.
I have a lot of forehead. Your hair doesn't grow back like to anymore, you know? Well, so when they shaved it, I was like, this may go bad. It took 3 months to grow back.
You're lucky
you know,
to go back,
my driver's
though.
License has no eyebrows. They made me go to the DMV and get a new license with no eyebrows.
Okay, that's funny.
That's so sad. Yeah.
He's on like the TSA. He's on like the list now because they're like, he has no eyebrows.
Yeah. Did you I'm a, like a see something, say something.
Right, right.
Did you have to wear like big framed glasses to sort of compensate?
It was so weird. It was like a month and a half in when they were kind of growing back, but not quite. Fans, when they would see me, obviously the episode hadn't aired yet, so fans didn't know whether I was getting better or getting worse in that weird middle phase, you know?
Oh, man. By the way, I'm flipping through your book because it is intriguing to me. Again, Murr from Practical Jokers has written the book Awakened, a novel by James S. Murray with Darren Wehrmuth. Is it Wehrmuth? How do I say his name?
Wehrmuth. Yep, yeah. Wehrmuth. So we were doing press a few weeks ago, and the reporter just didn't realize and kept calling him Darren Werewolf.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah, you gotta, I think it's so fun.
Yeah. You got to read your notes or just even the cover of the book.
Exactly.
The cover of the book will help tremendously. Yes. That'll work out. So you have so from what I can tell so far, flipping through the book, is that you have a lot of people dying. You're writing some of their last breaths. How do you put yourself in those situations?
Comedy and horror are flip sides of the same coin because they are oftentimes something that's scary to you. After you get scared, 5 minutes later, you're laughing at the fact that you got scared. So they're very much connected. And it's not, you know, imagination is imagination. You just, you know, when you're creating anything, you just, what we try to do as comedians is elicit reactions from people, you know, in a positive way. And the book is the same thing. I'm just trying to elicit a reaction and to create a visual image that is interesting and easy and fun to read. And it reads like an episode of the best episode of the TV show 24, you know, with Kiefer Sutherland. Just like fast-paced, action-packed, cliffhanger endings. You can't put it down. I wanted to write something that really felt in the moment and real and fun. You've taken on this kind of ride with the characters, with the Grace Love characters. And so it wasn't as hard as you think. It was... I think the comedy and horror are very closely tied.
And it's necessary, too, because it really drives the energy of any storytelling, I think.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And the cool thing, I don't know if you guys heard, they told you we hit number one on the international bestseller list.
Congratulations.
Oh, very cool. Isn't that cool? Yeah, we hit it a week or two ago. We're number one on the international bestseller, so it's pretty cool.
That is outstanding.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And again, pick this book up anywhere books are sold. And you mentioned that there's the next one is coming out next year, and it's called Brink, correct?
Yeah, the Brink the comes Brink. Out June 18th of next year.
And then you're working on the final installment of the
yes
the trilogy, and
yep.
So since you wrote this 14 years ago, but I, of course you've had to tweak it and sit down with Darren and work on this some more. I mean, did you imagine when you wrote this the first time it would have this arc?
I always thought it would be a trilogy. I wrote it as a trilogy, and the real goal too is that my background is in TV development. I've worked in TV development for 10 years now, 12 years. So the intention of it always was to develop it as a TV series, which I think would be wild.
And here's the thing, Andre, I don't know if you, now we obviously are in, the month of scary movies. Are you envisioning making this into a movie? And I think that Andre and I would be all in.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that'd be. Oh, you guys want to be in it?
Can we have cameos? Yes.
Be in it? Yeah.
We'll be on the train.
I'll be
on the train as it pulls into the station.
Yeah. I'll leave a bloody handprint.
Yeah. You don't have crimson on your hand.
That's my fingerprints.
That's my hand.
That's my hand there. I mean, at this point, now that you know more about getting into development and producers and how this works, I'm guessing you've already had those conversations.
Yeah, we actually pitched it as a TV series this fall. You know, the first thing I did when I sold the book was to immediately get to work on the TV development of it and to sell the TV rights. And now we go out this fall to pitch as a series.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's excellent. I was thinking movie, but you're right. I mean, everything that's being done well is being done on television now.
Look, if somebody wants to make a movie, I'll take their money gladly.
Sure. Yeah, no kidding. Well, and it's also, I mean, the visually, I can tell from the writing so far that it looks like it should be spectacular. And really, congratulations on this. Again, everyone can pick up Awakened. It's by James S. Murray, Murr from Impractical Jokers, with Darren Wehrmuth. And they've collaborated to make this a very scary book. And what's in store for Impractical Jokers?
Next week we finish shooting season 7. Season 7 goes through the end of this year. Season 8 starts next February. And next year, the Joker's movie comes out in theaters worldwide.
Of course it does.
Cool. Oh,
what?
We finished shooting the movie about 3 months ago, and it comes out next year.
Oh, man. And now, I mean, like 7 years in, do you feel at some point like you've thrown everything against the wall, or are you excited when you come up with something new, some new way?
We made a promise to each other in season 1 that if we ever felt like we weren't pushing the format of the show or still doing new, interesting twists on things or advancing the hook of it, we would stop doing it. And I got to tell you, it still works. Like, it's just, the guys are so immensely creative, my three friends, and we know each other so well that it's actually not that as hard as you think to come up with new twists on the show and pushing the format. And it's also just a lot of fun to do. My job is to go to set and make my best friends laugh, and that's not a bad job.
And make them do stupid things.
Yeah, well, that's true.
The fun things. I dare you. I triple dare you. Well, I want to congratulate you and thank you again for joining us tonight. And we'd love to, if you're ever coming through Chicago, I know that you've already done the book tour for this, but if you find yourself here, we'd love to have you in studio.
I'd love to come by. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a great night and get to work on that last book, will you?
Good luck with the eyebrows. Yes.
I will do. I'll finish it up right now.
Right now. Get it done. Get it done. I'm kidding. Have a great night. Thank you. Thanks, Mer.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Thank you. More after this on 720 WGN. You are listening to the Patty Vasquez Show with Andrea Darlis. And Andrea, we've lived here our entire lives. Are we the only ones at the station? I'm going to just go. No, I think Rose lived here. Anna Devontae's moved for a while. She lived in Texas for a bit.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
You are, yeah, we have lived here
our entire lives.
I've lived in Illinois my whole life.
Me too. Never lived anywhere else.
I mean, I lived in Champaign, Joliet, Orland Park. Lived, but only in Illinois. Isn't that crazy?
It is. It is kind of crazy. But I think part of it is that I love my city.
Yeah, we love Chicago.
I love my city. I love the food. Yep. I love the people. And one of the things I think we can lay claim to is some of the best theater in the world. Oh, and that's why we love having Theater Thursday. And we want to welcome to the studio Anne and Emily, who are a part of the production of Les Innocents. Am I saying this right? Someone tell me how you're pronouncing Les
Innocents.
Les Innocents.
Les Innocents.
Why do I even bother?
I love Les Innocents. I love it.
Can I say the Innocent?
Les Innocents.
The Innocents. Yeah. That works.
This sounds like it. We just spoke to an author who wrote a very creepy book about the subway tunnels in New York. And this sounds like you've got some ghoulish, ghostly activity going on in the catacombs in Paris.
Absolutely.
Ooh.
This takes place in the Paris catacombs. It was inspired by a real concert that happened down there in 1897.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, are there like stories about this concert? Are there, what kind of inspired this now to be a play, to be a stage production?
Well, I had the idea when I was down in the Paris catacombs.
You
go down as a visitor on a tour, and they have an audio tour. And at the very end of it, they briefly mentioned a real concert that happened down there. And the catacombs are, it's an amazing phenomenon. It's 200 miles of a labyrinth underneath the city.
What?
Seven stories underneath Paris. And only about 2 of those miles have skeletons. And there's about 6 million skeletons down there.
Wait. What?
Okay, I'm sorry. That's kind of cool.
6 million? So they used to just take bodies and just shove them down there. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they were digging out all the limestone to build the city. And as they were doing that, they were collapsing the city into these tunnels and the cemeteries were collapsing. And there's this one story of a woman who was in her cellar doing laundry or whatever down there.
Oh, no.
And her cellar wall collapsed, and raining down at her feet were all of these skeletons.
Oh,
wow.
So they decided to unearth all the cemeteries in Paris and bring down all these skeletons to the catacombs. And now, today, you can even go and see, and they stack them all up very neatly, and often they crumble and fall down because they're decaying. And you can go down there as a tourist. And
Did the concert happen before all of this, the one in 1897, or as this was happening?
So this was after, and the catacombs have a storied history. The Nazis had a bunker down there when they occupied Paris. There's been a fully functional movie theater down there. They don't know how many entrances and exits there are. Restaurants have entrances.
Field trip.
Doesn't anybody worry about the structural soundness if, you know, when they were creating these, they weakened the structures above them? Or I guess they've checked it?
Well, they went in and reinforced it.
Yeah. Okay. Right, Emily? Am I right?
I would never. I would never go down there.
You wouldn't really? Come on. Now?
I watched a movie about the catacombs, a thriller called As Above, So Below, and they went down there, and it did not turn out very well.
See, that would have a negative impact on your impression.
Would you go?
I don't know.
I would.
All right. You let me know how it is.
You would go. I probably would go. Horror movies.
I also, and I know it's not like spelunking, but like that idea of being underground.
Cave diving?
Yeah. Like it's just, and then you're surrounded by also skeletons. I mean, I like skeletons, and don't get me wrong, but it also reminds me of Raiders of the Ark or something, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You are up close and personal. I will tell you that I definitely slipped on the wet ground and stuck my fingers into a skull.
What? Human skull.
Like a bowling ball.
I'm out.
Oh, that's cool. That's what I'm saying.
You want your hand in a skeleton's eyeball?
No, but like I just think like the whole concept sounds really neat.
Okay.
You're not supposed to do that.
I like the catacombs. I think this would be neat.
This is funny because I like haunted houses.
Yeah.
And you want to go to the catacombs.
I know.
Okay.
Isn't that weird?
It's interesting. I mean, I like graveyards and everything. This is just seems a little bit more exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so up close and personal with death in a really terrifying way. I think maybe I would go as a tourist. Because you can have a little separation there. You can have someone guiding you.
Yeah,
but I'm not trying to go by myself.
No. You're with a bunch of people.
Yeah, are you trying to go by yourself?
No, I'd go with people. Absolutely not. No.
Solo tour?
No.
All right, I would go with you. We need to do a remote. Michael, can you put that into the station? We would like to do a remote from Paris.
We could do like a Steve Bertrand trip to Paris and see the catacombs.
Now you're thinking.
That we should do.
I think we could do that. And there must be incredible ghost stories about these catacombs. How could there not be?
Absolutely, and we wrote one of our own.
Yes, we did.
So we found a way to bring an audience to that concert. That was the inspiration for this piece. And so we have now this epic queer thriller that takes our audience to that concert or a version of that concert.
I'm curious, what type of music is played at the concert?
At the real-life concert?
Yes.
Are you familiar with Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre?
Yes, do.
That was written about the catacombs.
Oh,
there you go. Wow. I had no idea. I may have pulled that one up for some background music on this one. And then, was it part of the con? I mean, how much did they know about that original concert and how much have you used to base your play on? Or have you kind of gone off and you know, the idea of conjuring souls or, you know, trying to talk to the dead in your production?
That was the jumping off point.
Yeah.
We veered off from there. This show is not a concert, I should say.
This is a version of it. Let me find another one. Let me find the original.
So I say, for 1897, they were pretty progressive.
Yeah.
So that was the inspiration and the jumping off point, and sort of, you know, the idea of trying to connect with the dead.
Absolutely. So we've created a character that Emily plays named Guy, who is a composer who goes down to the catacombs supposedly to find the love of their life. And they perform a seance, and the seance wakes up many other ghosts besides Mathilde, who they're looking for.
I love that.
And they have to reckon with their dead, and the ghosts have to reckon with the fact that they are dead.
Okay.
And what happens in the afterlife when you're not absolved, and when you still have your same desires and same wants, and you're a jerk in the exact same ways after you're dead. It's not the great equalizer, but you continue on just as you were.
This is lovely. We are talking to Emily and Anne. Emily Modaff?
Modaff.
Modaff and Anne Kreitman. Anne is, you're the director and the co-writer? Or did you both write this, or did you write this? This is incredible.
I wrote this and directed it.
I just listen to Anne and do what I'm told.
I like that feeling as well.
How was she as a director?
Amazing.
Okay, good.
Amazing. I'm being pushed in incredible ways right now as an actor.
Are we really being told we need to specify Paris, France? Are there people that are really confusing Paris, Illinois with or Paris, Texas with the catacombs that we're talking about?
Well, it's called Les Innocents.
Paris. I'm sorry. If I say Paris, will that help with everyone? Well, also, by the way, savoir faire is everywhere. I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself. We are talking to the... What were you saying?
I was going to say that the actually speaking French in this play is so hard. It is so, so hard.
Do you speak French?
As a human being,
yeah, no. Yeah, in general, okay.
I am French, and I only say, I mean, I probably only say three French words in this show, and it is the greatest struggle of
really?
My life.
What are the words?
What's the one I can't do? It's fraternité. Fraternité.
Fraternité.
Fraternité.
Fraternité.
I just be like, I was having a recording, and just like, move your lips. And just
punch it in.
Like,
lips
exactly.
It.
Fraternité.
In a ghostly way.
Another?
What else do I say?
Just trying to...
Bonsoir.
I say bonsoir.
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 Okay, bonsoir. You can say that.
I can say bonsoir.
Yeah, bonjour, bonsoir.
I can say c'est sens.
There you go.
And what c'est sens mean?
C'est sens.
That's composer.
The
artist.
The composer.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Who and we've I just heard from.
Oh, there you go.
I took a year of French and I know je vais à la plage.
So there you go.
I'm going to the beach.
Je ne sais quoi.
Is that right?
I don't speak French either, but I do know how to ask for the check.
Oh, nice. How do you say that?
L'édition, monsieur.
No, s'il vous plaît. You don't say...
Oh, yes, s'il vous plaît.
Oui, if you say please.
We don't say that at all in the show.
You don't say... You don't
Nobody
say,
says please.
Nobody
oh,
says
wait,
please.
Oh, wait, I say please in English. Never mind.
if I may say please, I have to run to a break. We are hanging out with Anne and Emily. We would encourage you to find out more about this production of Les Innocents?
The Innocents.
The Innocents, thank
Les
you.
Innocents.
Yeah, she's like, go ahead and say it in English. I will. And you can go to Rediscover Theater, right? Rediscovertheater.com for ticket information. This is at the Preston Bradley Center at 941 West Lawrence, running October 7th through November 4th. More with our guests when we come back on 720 WGN. It's the Patty Vasquez Show with Andre Darlis. I'm intrigued by our guests, not only about the production they're doing, The Innocents, running October 7th through November 4th at Preston Bradley Center, which is located at 941 West Lawrence Avenue. You can go to rediscovertheater.com. And this sounds like a wonderful sort of... you know, journey into this this concert that was held in the catacombs in 1897, you said, and this kind of search for love and encountering the dead and what that all brings. But I want to know a little bit more about Emily, where are you from? You said Emily, right?
Yes.
I know people probably are like, what do I pronounce
Emile,
it?
Emile.
Emily, where are you from?
I just grew up in the southwest suburbs in Lisle.
Lisle, Illinois.
Oh, yeah.
That's where our friends Giant Steps is. That's where their school is in Lisle, Illinois.
Yeah.
And I love that area. It's a school
test?
For autism. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We'll talk later.
We'll
I know people there.
We'll talk later. Well, it's a great area too because I mean it's like it's you know it's not quite Naperville. You know, you get to have your own identity.
Right.
It's like a little bit more wide open, you know, a little bit more, I don't know, just have your own identities is kind of a big part of it. And were you always interested in theater?
Yeah, absolutely. I did think I wanted to play softball for a minute, but...
Forever?
that I lost that real quick. There's not a lot of theater in Lisle. There is a lot in Naperville, but... Mm-hmm. Growing up, we had maybe two productions in high school.
Oh, really?
Two productions a year. But the moment I was in my first play in third grade, and
aww.
I was pretty obsessed with it. I was really in love with it. So when I got to the age where my parents realized I actually wanted to do it, they allowed me to take the Metra down here once a week to do the Looking Glass Young Ensemble and start learning some real stuff from some professionals.
And what a great experience. The Looking Glass is just
incredible.
You know, premiere. That's fantastic.
It was a culture
was
shock
like?
For me.
Yeah.
I mean, I have deep roots there. The MODAFs have been there for a very long time since Lisle was founded. So
what?
It was exciting for me. Yeah. So there's Yackley Road too out there.
Yeah.
That's my grandmother's family. And she,
come on.
Yeah, she was an opera singer. And so she gave me my love for singing. I started singing in church with my grandmother, Roberta Modaf, Roberta Yackley. But when I started to get down into the city, I realized that it was going to be a lifetime journey. So I ended up coming to college here. I went to Columbia. And I've been here for almost 10 years.
Cool.
That is lovely.
Yeah.
How cool is that you have a major road named after your family?
Well,
you're like the Ryan, the Stevenson. Oh, you got two.
We have Modaf Road and Yackley Road.
Come on.
That's and they cool. married each other. And then I was born and now I'm here.
Oh, that's cool.
That's incredible. I mean, I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody who was like family, basically was there at the founding of a community.
Yeah, it's really special to have that connection there. Although I cannot go to the Jewel without someone
making a joke about
wondering who my father is.
I still love how you say the Jewel.
The Jewel?
Because I used to work at the Jewel in high school.
Did you?
I did. I was a bagger and then I was a checker. But I always say the Jewel too, and people are like, "Oh, yeah. The Jewel." I went,
"It's the Jewel."
What do you call it? It's the Jewel.
Go to the Jewel.
Yeah.
I don't know. I spent more time at the Dominic's, but
not anymore.
Did you have to join a union when you were working at the Jewel?
I did. I was 16 years old, and I was in the union. I had to pay union dues, and oh my god! But back then, it was like, you know, minimum wage was $3.35. I'm still dating myself. But the Jewel, when you worked at the Jewel, you get $4.05 an hour.
And then,
so that was big time. And the union dues were like $1.82.
Right. It was huge.
Yeah,
no, I'm sorry. My friends worked at some of the grocery stores and they were union.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always funny to have like my classmates who are 16 and in a union. Yeah.
Do I get a union pension?
Yeah. I would check with the Jewel.
I am looking that up. I'm writing a letter.
And where are you from?
I'm from Libertyville.
Okay, so the opposite direction.
Opposite direction.
Yeah. Up by there. Mm-hmm. And where'd you go to high school?
Libertyville High School.
Was there a good theater program, or were you not quite interested in theater yet?
No, high school was exactly what I got into theater. I needed that community. And at the time, we had kind of a freak group of very talented people. Pippa Sue, who went on to now star in Hamilton, was
cool
at Libertyville High School that time. Johnny Oleksinski, who had been a writer, is now, I think, at the New York Daily. Not quite sure.
Don't you guys have a really spectacular choir as well?
The choir was excellent. The band was excellent.
Yeah,
good music programs.
Because I know at Christmas they do a lot of concerts, the Libertyville Choir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did not sing, but I did theater.
That's a good school.
I'm the same way. I don't sing.
Mm-mm.
It's not my thing.
No, that's not my job in the show.
I do sing in the show.
I'll see. There's some music to it.
There's some really beautiful music in the show.
How did you incorporate the music? What did you do to fold that in? You know, what was your aim with it?
Well, to be honest, it was an accident.
Oh, really?
I have casted some incredible musicians, and there are two buskers in the show. And I tasked them with coming up with some songs about their life before their death, and then as well as making music together as a community. And they have really surprised me and have created some beautiful music. And Emily also sings in the show a song as part of the seance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and go ahead.
But these two men have written some music that I find myself humming on the train. They're so talented.
That is impactful.
Yeah. And they are the comedic relief of the show. I love them.
How big is your cast?
It's 10 people.
Okay. That's a good size. It's a good size because you have a lot of different characters, a lot of different voices.
Absolutely. And something I wanted to do with this show was not make it too dark, too depressing. There's a lot of gallows humor, a lot of dark comedy, and the buskers are responsible for a lot of that. So it's not too dark and depressing. We are dealing with heavy subjects, but in an irreverent way, in a subversive way, in a way that is going to surprise the audience.
Okay.
Very cool.
And what did you do? What was the sort of concept when it came to the stage design for the set?
So it is an immersive show,
which
means we're taking the audience on a journey to the catacombs. The audience are in and among the ghosts. They are a ghost themselves as they go in.
What?
Yep.
That's neat.
So the audience proceeds through the catacombs, is eventually offered a seat, but they are treated as one of the group.
Okay. That's lovely.
And we've created a 360 experience. So we've thought about what they smell when they enter the space. There's a surprise that comes in your email box the day you're going to see the show. We've really tried to think outside the box here with our audience and not just assume that they're going to sit right. far away from us in the dark, but
can you
really
imagine
be part of it.
Yeah, getting an email. It's like, oh my God, how do they know? There are ghosts.
Ooh,
that's cool.
I feel like I should turn the lights down for this interview.
Yeah.
It was too bright in here. And this is Thursdays through Sundays at 8 p.m. Tell me a little bit about Rediscover Theater. How did you guys get involved with this theater company?
So I am the co-artistic director of Rediscover Theater. And I have been the co-artistic director for a little over a year mm-hmm. now. We were founded in 2012. And since then, we have been an immersive theater company in Chicago. So rather than picking up a script first, we usually find a venue and then think about how we want our audience to move through that venue and create a story from there.
I've never heard of that.
No, that's cool.
I've never heard of that.
This is my first show with mm-hmm. Rediscover, but last year I saw their show 4-1, which was at Burger Park, the Mansion, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a show where everybody gets, you're an audience of one for five or six different shows. And I was extremely nervous to see five shows by myself. And I left that show with it being in my top five of last year. So when I got called in to audition, I was floored because it was truly like one of the most personal theater experiences I've ever had.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, I look forward to hearing more and look forward to seeing The Innocents. You say it for me.
Les Innocents.
Les Innocents.
Les Innocents. That's fantastic. Everyone go to rediscovertheater.com. Again, it runs October 7th through November 4th, Thursdays through Sundays at 8 p.m. at Preston Bradley Center, 941 West Lawrence Avenue. And I want to thank Emily and Anne for joining us tonight. I look forward to seeing you guys again. I really do.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on this production. Have fun. Have fun.